Nous recevons Triane. Et nous recevons le collectif Métissé.
Hello and welcome to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com. I am Richard Moore, the author of Tour de France 100 and Mastermind, a little ebook about Dave Brailsford, which is my first plug of that. I'm joined tonight by Lionel Burney, publisher of the Sean Kelly biography, Hunger.
That's right.
And also the Cycling Anthology, editor of the Cycling Anthology.
Good evening, Richard.
And Daniel Freeb.
Don't bother with the book club. Let's just get on.
Okay, I won't. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Rich.
Lionel, where are we tonight?
Well, we're in San Marlo on the Brittany coast, and we're in a hotel, Hotel Oceana, I think, overlooking the sea. Quite a breezy evening, so we come inside. We're in the bar, which has been drunk dry of beer. I suspect the hordes of British cycling fans who've come over the channel for today's stage have spoiled it for us. So we're having a glass of rosé instead, which jolly nice and summery.
Tonight we're going to be discussing today's stage and finishing St Malo. We're going to also carry on the inquest into what happened on Sunday's stage, talk a little bit about the rest day. We've got interviews with Rolf Aldag, with Charlie Wigelius and Tim Kerrison. All right, lots to talk about because we won the Inertia Prize yesterday for missing our podcast on the rest day.
Great
pressure of a long 700-kilometer transfer north from the Pyrenees. Daniel, well, today, I mean, we're fortunate that we've still got our tape recorder here so that we can record this podcast because there was an incident after the stage which had a crash at the end. Mark Cavendish was deemed by some to be responsible, but not by the race jury. He cut across Tom Wielers, hit his arm quite heavily, and down went Wielers. Cavendish was third. Kittel won his second stage ahead of Greipel. And Mark wasn't very happy, was he? I think you went to see him, Daniel.
Wow, I was one of hundreds, I think, out there, crammed against the ropes outside the Omega Pharma bus. He actually didn't react. He wasn't reacting too badly, but then he was asked, was it your fault? And I think it was partly the question, partly the journalist who asked it. He's had a few run-ins with that particular journalist before. And he got slightly irritated and he tea-leafed his recorder in a fairly sneaky manner, didn't he?
Did you see it? Yeah, it wasn't aggressive.
No, it wasn't very demonstrative. It was, he kind of shuffled towards him and the claw came out and suddenly the recorder had disappeared and it was on there. And I understand, Mark, wait, but he pretty much confiscated it, didn't he, and put it on the
step.
Oh,
here comes our wine. Wonderful. Yes, he did. Yeah, it was slightly threatening looking. Not a great thing for him to have done, I don't think, in particular. It was a reasonable question, wasn't it?
It's the fun of the fair, isn't it?
Thank you very much. Merci. Wonderful. Some little bites. Lionel, don't eat that before you give us your view of... I don't want to come to you with your mouth full.
Okay, well, I'll... what do you want me to...
Well, we're talking about Cavendish. What was your view of the incident first?
Well, Cavendish was going forward, trying to get involved in the sprint, and Wielers was coming backwards, having done his lead-out work for Kittel. And when you've got riders going in different directions at different speeds, a collision is more likely to cause a crash. If they've both been sprinting full on, elbow to elbow, Wielers probably would have stayed up, wouldn't he? Because it wasn't. It was a little nudge. It wasn't a hard collision. But this is one of the problems of sprinting at the moment, with the lead outs being so key and so many teams getting involved with the lead out. And today, I mean, we saw Orica trying to get up there, Argos were up there, Lotto, of course, and Omega Pharma. You've got this phenomenon of the lead-out men kind of almost flying back towards the sprinters as if they sort of...
That's very dangerous, yeah.
And it is dangerous. It makes it really hard for the guys who are trying to come off the wheels to contest the sprint. They've got to pick their way. Well, not pick their way. They've just got to hope that the guys coming back at them aren't going to be in their way. And... you know, it may have been an avoidable one for Cavendish, but there wasn't an awful lot of road for him to play with.
And it was fairness, a tricky sprint, wasn't it?
Yeah, and in fairness, Vilas was kind of zigzagging slightly as he moved, as he faded back into the middle of the oncoming bunch as well, which is it's never very helpful, is it?
No, and it's something that lead-out men do, perhaps deliberately. They become a sort of obstacle. Not to make it dangerous, just so that the sprinters coming by and have to go round them rather than, you know, having daylight in front of them. Cavendish wasn't going to win that sprint, though, was he?
No, he wasn't. And again, Quickstep made no bones about this. Omega Pharma Quickstep, that it was a very poor execution by them. From about 2 kilometres to go, that is when Lotto have decided that it is the best time to disrupt their train, and it truly is, because from Kwiatkowski onwards, the way the train's set up in this tour, it all seems to go wrong, it all seems to derail for Cavendish, and the speed is no longer high enough, and it mystifies them, because I think we'll hear from Rolf Aldag, who is the technical manager at Quickstep later, you know, they have the horsepower, and the team time trial proved that they have the horsepower, but it's a question of commitment, or it's a question of, I think commitment is the big word. And
commitment, or as Patrick Lefebvre said, balls. That's what he said after Skelderpriest, the semi-classic in Belgium in April, when they were muscled out there by Argo Shimano as well, actually, and you know, this is an issue. Having the power is one thing, but having the balls, having the fearlessness that you need.
And also just the ability to take control. And I think, you know, Rolf Aldag, the way he describes the current situation at Quickstep, is almost like Cavendish is having to play the role of, he's almost a player manager in the lead out train, and he's having to call all the shots and direct everyone. And, you know, there are no sort of what the French call automatisme, you know, there are no, nothing isn't is coming natural to those guys. They're waiting for instructions from Cav, and it's all very mechanical at the moment. You know, Stegemans today, I don't know what he was thinking. He was trying to take Cav to the front with about 800 metres to go. And, you know, it flies in the face of just the most basic technicals or precepts when it comes to sprinting.
It's the kind of thing you do if you're a little bit scared.
You
try and get to the front. And you know, this is why there is talk of Mark Renshaw going back to Cavendish next year, perhaps joining Omega Pharma. You know, he was the lead out man for Cavendish for the peak years, you know, where he won so many stages of the tour. His rate of winning is slowing down, you know, and I think I think the speed is still there. I think the big difference is, and we've been talking about this a little bit, that this tour, a lot of these stage wins so far have owed to teamwork. You know, Cannondale on Friday with Sagan. You know, Sky on Saturday with Froome. Movistar were the dominant team on Sunday, but and also, you know, Ulrika Greenedge had a team plan that propelled Simon Gerrans to his stage win. And this is the first year I can remember where so many stage wins, you can say that guy won because of his team. Greipel as well, and then Kittel today.
Yeah, although I thought actually Lotto probably
today,
probably they probably got the lead out the most right of
and Greipel
of those
said
teams.
That actually,
and Greipel didn't quite have the speed to bring it home. And I mean, take nothing away from Kittel, he is quick. I mean, he's getting quicker as well, and I think he doesn't rely on having a big train in front of him. He's won two now without having, you know, the same resources in terms of numbers that Lotto and Omega Pharma are dedicating to their sprinter. And I think, you know, he was pretty resourceful as well in the way he moved up, got up to the front, and you know, brought it home.
I think as well, what's interesting is that the other teams are really, they're kind of scenting blood with Omega Pharma, and the more an opposing sprint train feels that they are vulnerable, the more they will mass to the front, and the more damage and the more disruption they will cause. And that's what's happening. You know, we saw for a long time when there was kind of a widespread resignation to Cavendish's superiority, and in that situation teams almost took a back seat and they just left High Road HTC, you know, to do their thing and didn't really meddle with them, didn't really get involved too much. Now it really is a free-for-all at the end, because they know that there are gains to be, there are there is success to be had by doing that.
Well, I think we'll hear now from Rolf Aldag, technical manager at Omega Pharma Quickstep, who can talk us a little bit of the way through what happened to Cavendish and the lead-out train at the end there.
Your plan today, has it altered? You know, Lotto have been saying this thing that now it's from 2.3, 2.4, 2.5, that's when they really come in. Have you done anything to kind of counteract that?
You know, we said tailwind stuff is super complicated. Yeah. Whatever you do it wrong.
And does that suit a bigger, more powerful sprinter more, perhaps? You know, a Kittel or a Greipel?
Well, yeah, I mean, we lose a little bit the aero advantage that Kev usually have. I mean, it's super small on the bike, so in a headwind sprint, people stay on the wheel, but once they get off his wheel, they catch the wind, tall, big guys with Greipel, and then they're used to stuck. They just say, oh, they're coming and they're going. It's usually the strength of a tailwind sprint. You don't really have that. But in any case, it wasn't really 100% executed what we thought we would do. You know, there was a moment that, I don't know at what distance, when Stegemans goes to the front, and then Kev just did decide not to go with him because he felt it was too early. Like, okay, then he sets me up at 400 in the wind, and what do I do from there? So I think he chose to take the risk to sprint from the wheel over the risk of I really gonna die in the front, and it didn't work out.
Yeah, and it was there, not between 2 and 500 meters, because that was kind of where Argos and.
And that's now the second time that you first have to catch up and get in position so short to the finish, and in the past it was always our strength. If you see the analyze from Kev's sprint, he hardly did put anything above 450 watt in the past. He was just smooth through the peloton. And that was always his big advantage over Andre when he was with us. I mean, we had analyses where Andre had to pass 1,200 watts two times in the last kilometer before he starts sprinting.
Yeah.
And then, you get so tired that there's just no peak anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was our big strength with Kev. So he's just surfing. He has this one big hit and he drops everybody and wins. You've seen it today that wasn't the case. He had a big working effort before. You've seen that on that sprint that Andre won, wherever that ended.
Yeah.
You see that, there was even an upper situation, even worse.
Yeah.
And it just kills sprinter's legs. I think you just can't do that. It just kills your legs.
And just generally, is it positioning? Is it horsepower? Or is it commitment? We've heard that word a few times. Commitment is the train committed enough? You know, are they getting their hands dirty?
I think it's many times routine. They really, really try. I mean, and horsepower, you're not really, really losing by 0.5 of a second, a 27-kilometer time trial, which is 58 average, if you lack horsepower. So I think horsepower is not really the issue. We're definitely missing routine. And I think, it's also not easy for Kev, because in the past he always had a guy who guided him, who's done the thinking for him. Who basically took a lot of stress from him, because he would just rely on him. The only thing he had to focus on was sprinting. Now he has to guide the team, he has to talk, he has to be vocal, verbal in that final, and still has to sprint. And it's not perfect, but as I said, I mean, it's routine. We have done it once perfect and twice far away from perfect, but what should we do? I think we keep on practicing.
The Tour de France with humansinvent.com. Innovation, craftsmanship and design.
Okay, we also wanted to sort of carry on the inquest into Sunday and what happened on Sunday's very dramatic stage, which saw racing from the gun and huge damage done to the Sky team, who fell apart. Chris Froome was okay. Much of yesterday was spent kind of discussing and pouring over exactly what happened, because it was a rest day and that's what you do on rest days. But there was a lot to talk about, and so we'll go into that. I think Lionel, you spoke to Charlie Wigelius this morning, because obviously their man from Garmin Sharp, Dan Martin, won the stage.
That's right. Well, Dan Martin won the stage, but it was Garmin Sharp that kicked it all off, really, very, very early on Sunday's stage. David Miller and Jack Bauer were two of the riders that were prompting a lot of the attacks early on, trying to get something going. And Charlie had tweeted something saying, praising both those guys, because they were aware that kicking off the aggression that early on such a hard stage that had to go over five Pyrenean cols, there was always the risk that if the pace carried on really hot at the front, that those guys could miss the time cut. And I mean, they were inside it perfectly happily at the finish, but it was a risk they were prepared to take in order to try and win the stage. So I had a chat with Charlie to find out who devised that plan, why they were prepared to risk everything, and whether they were going out for the stage win or to try and gain time overall. So this is Charlie.
Well, I'm with Charlie Wagelius at the start of stage 10, yes. After the rest day, Saint-Gildas-des-Bois. Quite an attractive little Breton village. Yep. Huge crowds this morning. The yep. tour really turns out in force when it visits these small towns and villages. Charlie is one of the sports directors, lead sports director, is that right, I think?
We don't have that kind of hierarchy.
With the Garmin Shark team. And I wanted to ask about Sunday's stage, which was one of the most memorable in recent tour history, really. And it was your team that mixed it up right from the start. So I wonder, what was the game plan and who devised it?
Well, it's Jonathan Vortus that really sets the tone in the team. He sends the message from above of what he wants, and he asked us to go for a high risk strategy, quite aware of the fact that that brings a potential cost with it. And for us sports directors, from the moment he made clear to us that he was also prepared to pay the cost of a high risk strategy gone wrong, that is essentially the green light for us to get busy with creative tactics. So from a management point of view, from when above, you have such a clear line like that, it makes life a lot easier.
So that meant, really, very early on, David Miller and Jack Bauer risking their entire tour yeah. by attacking early.
Yeah.
It was, I think, even before the Porte d'Aspe, which was the first climb, is that right? Or on the
slopes? Yeah, they were away already right from the beginning of the race, and you know, they put everything on the line before we'd even started the first of five Pyrenees passes, which really, For guys of that size and that weight, that's a huge risk to take, to put such a big effort in, you know, at the beginning of a stage like that. And they both did it without a second thought for their own safety, as it were. Mm-hmm. And I think that example was repeated throughout the stage. I mean, you see a guy like Ryder Heisdal, who's, you know, a recent winner of a three-week stage race, just putting himself on the line, you know, to pave the way for Dan. I think that's really symbolic of the spirit that the team showed.
So was it all for the stage win, or were you hoping to make bigger gains in the general classification? Because Daniel Martin moved up to eighth. He's still just under two and a half minutes off. But was it really all for the stage win? Was that the goal?
Yes. You know, we want to come away from this race with concrete achievements. And although, you know, from a strictly, you know, sporting point of view or an athletic point of view, finishing 11th or 12th or 13th in Paris is, it's massive. We want to, you know, to risk those kind of safer objectives for potentially something bigger. And I think that's what you saw the riders doing on Sunday, and I hope that the people at home enjoy it.
Well, it was certainly a fantastic stage. It really put Sky on the ropes, your early aggression, and as soon as Garmin Sharp were prepared to risk all for the stage, Movistar, Saxo Tinkoff and the rest with designs on the overall, they really joined in with making the race very aggressive. So
yeah.
When it came to the crunch for Daniel Martin, how much was your involvement in sort of trying to set the tone for when he should make his move, or is that purely down to the rider and his racing instinct?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, we can come up with smart ideas in the car, but I think it's really a fallacy to think that the riders are radio-controlled robots, you know. And at the end of the day, from the car, I can look at all the different kind of scenarios and suggest what would be the most productive way of going about it. But it's Dan who's riding, or the rider in any case, who feels his legs and who looks in the eyes of his rivals next to him, and it's up to them to, you know, interpret it as best they can. And I really don't want to sterilize them in any way and, you know, take away their spirit from them, because, you know, the instinct of the rider is always right, and it's their prerogative to follow that. So we can give them a broad outline and a suggestion of when the right time would be, and, you know, that a situation would be developing that's, you know, ripe for you know, going for the killer blow, but it's up to the rider himself to work that out, and I'd like it to stay like that.
When Jakob Fuglsang of Astana came across and joined forces with Daniel, did you think that was to Daniel's advantage, or were you concerned about him? Because we know he's a good climber, but
yeah,
probably...
I mean, obviously, you know, to have a guy like him with him was ideal, because obviously, you know, when he's not on his own anymore, that brings a risk of him getting beaten in the sprint, but he's here with classification ambitions, and he was always going to be fully committed to ride to the line. You know, winning isn't always straightforward, but at the end of a stage like that, I think it counts more, you know, how much energy you've got left. So I think you really needed some company to get to the line, because it was a long way.
And lastly, as we go into the second week now of the tour, it's been the most consistently hot Tour de France that I can remember. Mm. I know 2003 was very warm, but yeah. I don't think we've had a drop of rain fall on the race. We've not had an overcast day yet. The sun is absolutely scorching right from the off.
Yeah.
What kind of strategies have you got in place to cope with that? Because, of course, hydration becomes even more important.
Yeah. Well,
and it can't just be as simple as reminding the riders to take extra bottles.
Well, actually, I was speaking about that with David, who's got years of experience, and he said himself that he does actually need reminding to drink, because you get kind of frozen in the moment, which actually even surprised me. But Robbie Ketchell and our medical team, together they've developed, you know, really good drink mixes with, you know, extremely good electrolyte balances for these kind of situations. But it's just that the riders have to constantly kind of run the risk of filling their gut with too much water to keep themselves hydrated, and obviously everybody reacts a bit differently to that. And I think for some riders it might be a little bit tough after the extremely cold and wet spring that we had to suddenly find themselves in these conditions, so it's not easy.
Do you think that's why we saw some riders, particularly from when the pressure really went on, and riders who'd done a lot of hard work on the Saturday, and in the case of Sky, who'd been forced onto the back foot early, getting caught out a little bit because the change in conditions from even just 3 or 4 weeks ago has been extreme?
Yeah, I don't know about like the specific, you know, story of the Sky riders or so on, but in a more general way, I'd say that I think you could have a lot of athletes who were having crises on Sunday because of badly managed stages in Corsica that perhaps, you know, you don't see any obvious effect of it at the time, but kind of emptying the tank on days when it should really be remaining full. And that's really the skill in stage racing, is to distribute the resources in the most intelligent way, you know.
Excellent. Charlie Wegelius, thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to the Tour de France podcast with humansinvent.com and Sharp.
When we did eventually finish our long drive north from the Pyrenees up to Brittany yesterday, we went to the Team Sky press conference where, you know, Chris Froome appeared and the rest of the team. There was a lot of curiosity about exactly what happened on Sunday. We wondered whether there was some kind of illness or something wrong. I just remember today, actually, that on the first rest day last year, one Sky rider didn't appear for the rest day because he was a little bit under the weather, and that was Richie Porte. And there's a lot of talk about Richie Porte again, lost a bit of time today, sat up. You know, his performance on Sunday was so below what had been on Saturday. There was a dramatic sort of collapse there by him that people were wondering if there was something wrong with him. I suspect that he wouldn't have appeared at the press conference if there was something wrong with him in terms of illness or something. But did we learn anything yesterday at the Team Sky press conference?
It was interesting to listen to Pete Kenyon, who's been a revelation in the tour so far. And, you know, I got the impression when Sky picked Pete Kenyon, he was almost a bonus ball. They were throwing him in, and that anything he did was almost, it was a bonus that he was there for experience, and they felt they had enough firepower with eight guys. But in fact, he's been one of their strongest riders so far, and they'll rely on him heavily. But, you know, we also sort of assumed a few weeks ago, and actually we have this confirmed to us to a certain extent, that, you know, his career was in limbo to a certain extent, certainly in the short term, because he was supposed to do the Giro d'Italia, wasn't picked. We learned yesterday that actually he had asked not to be picked. And you know, it looked like it was going to be a very difficult season for him, and a season where he really didn't make all that much progress. But here he is in the Tour all of a sudden, and he's just taken a massive leap. His career has taken a huge step forward.
It's interesting because I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, actually, and he told me that about that calling up Rod, and it was a big, you know, big call for him to, you know, deselect himself from the Giro, and he needed to be talked into it. And there was no, the plan then was to put him in the Vuelta.
Yeah.
But his form came around. He had a very heavy April, and he seemed to really benefit from that. And his form came around. He had a foot injury or something, I think, at the end of last year, and that delayed his start to the year. But his form just suddenly came. He also mentioned something quite interesting, that he lost a lot of weight. He said 5 kilos now. I don't know if that's accurate or not. But now this is something that we've seen with a few of the Sky Riders, that they are skin and bone. And it has become the sort of holy grail of performance in Grand Tours, hasn't it? Getting your weight down as low as possible. We've seen it with Bradley Wiggins as well.
It has. Well, every kilogram counts, doesn't it, when you've got to lug it over the mountains. If you can be as light as possible but retain your strength from the training, it's a really tricky balance to strike. And Sky have got a nutritionist called Nigel Mitchell, who is based most of the time back in Manchester, and he devises the diet plans, and it's a really carefully controlled weight loss program that balancing the needs of the athlete to lose weight whilst retaining the physical strength, but also taking into account that, you know, we've talked about this before, that riding the Tour de France is verging on being unhealthy. You know, being at extremely low body fat percentages is on the verge of being unhealthy. And a guy like Nigel Mitchell, with the knowledge he's got of nutrition and making sure that riders are eating the most calorie efficient food, I think is probably the best way to put it. So they're making sure that they're getting the calories and the nutrition they need from relatively small kind of portions, and avoiding foods that will add bulk up and add fat or any other kind of excess weight. So, you know, these plans are not kind of just drawn up on the back of a fag packet. They are carefully planned, and it's not something that's done quickly. It's not something that's done over, you know, 2 or 3 weeks. It's something that's planned for over, 6-8 weeks leading up to a race like the Tour, to make sure that the rider not just loses the weight, because that is important, but make sure that they are healthy and strong enough, and their immune systems aren't compromised by losing that weight quickly.
I asked Chris Froome a while ago whether he'd worked with Nigel Mitchell, because he's very, very lean, and he said he'd never worked with him, which interested me.
But Rich, I would say that I would dispute the idea that this is new to Scott. This is something that Scott...
No, I'm not saying that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. I think that the two very infamous Italian doctors, Michele Ferrari and Luigi Cecchini in the 90s, I think they were famous for their obsession with riders' weight, and you know, and I think Italian riders in general in the 90s took this to fairly extreme levels, you know, and they have different teams, different riders have different methods of doing it. I mean, there's the it's a sort of anecdote that I've told a few times, because it's pretty funny, that Luca Cinto of the Vini Fantini team, he just sends riders text messages every day, don't eat, so non mangiare, don't eat. That's his method for doing it. So, but that's what it comes down to, isn't it? You know, yeah, just not eating, basically.
Going back to the late 70s, early 80s, when Sean Kelly was, you know, quite a chunky rider. Jean de Gribaldi, the kind of legendary sports director of Kelly's team, he was obsessed with diet as well, and Kelly considers him to be kind of ahead of the curve in terms of weight loss. And I mean, his instructions at the end of the season, when Kelly went back to Ireland, would have a checklist of things that he was and wasn't allowed to eat. And even on races, you know, the portion control would be pretty extreme. Di Gribaldi had some quite sort of strange ideas about what riders should and shouldn't eat. Some of it, you know, we now know is were correct ideas, but some of them were a little bit wacky, off the wall, things that Di Gribaldi barred his riders from eating. So yeah, the relationship between food,
salads.
I heard
today, always something banned by the French.
I heard today, and this is something I've got to verify, but there is a very prominent rider in this Tour de France. I'm not going to name him because I need to check this first, but who has been chewing tobacco in an effort to lose weight.
Really?
Correct. Yeah.
Chewing tobacco is very potent. Is it chewing tobacco.
It's, what do they call the stuff in that they, it's very popular in Scandinavia that you put under your gun.
I had a horrendous experience with
or something.
Chewing tobacco a couple of years ago.
Apparently there is someone who has adopted this as a method of weight loss.
It's not doping, is it?
I don't think so.
No, but it's, I mean, it's a drug.
Yeah, and presumably it's an appetite suppressant.
Interesting. Well, talking about Ferrari and, you know, weight and stuff, it does take us on to a topic that has been rumbling away for discussion since Chris Froome's victory, actually, on Saturday. You know, the stopwatches came out as soon as he rode up Axe Trois Domaines on Saturday, and there have been all sorts of comparisons made with previous performances and calculations of his power to weight, his VAM, etc., etc., etc. It was something Sky were asked a bit about yesterday. There is this question of should they release power data so that people can use that to try and ascertain whether they are doping or not. My view on this, and I interviewed Tim Kerrison last night. We're going to play a bit of the Tim Kerrison interview later on, which is really him looking back on Sunday's stage. But also in that interview, we obviously asked him all about this topic, and we're going to play that later in the week, or bits of it. But the real question I was interested in, is there a magic? Is there a figure that indicates doping? Is there some kind of magic number in terms of power to weight or whatever that proves incontrovertibly that somebody is doping? And I have a real problem with that idea, with that assumption that we know what human beings are capable of. Lionel?
Well, there's a lot of things. I mean, I got into this debate on our long drive.
Oh,
the
yes.
other day.
I thought you went quiet for a while.
Yeah, there's a lot of... The big problem is that people are trying to analyse quite complex performances on the open road in conditions that are not, you know, they're not consistent. Comparing a ride in 2013 to another ride 10 or 11 years previously in completely different conditions without taking into account the way the race was actually contested, without taking into account where in the race these particular stage in question fell. That on its own is a grey area. That's before you even get into when doing these calculations. Have we got the weight of the rider correct? You know, that is absolutely critical. Have we got the weight of the bike correct? Do we know what the wind speed is? You know, do we know that the distance of the climb as printed in the Tour de France roadbook is accurate? Do we know if the height gain on that particular climb is accurate? You know, these things have to be measured accurately, or else the calculations that you get out at the end are going to be way off. And I think the frustration is that there are valid questions to be asked, definitely. There are good ways to go about it, but it strikes me as not particularly scientific to be timing a rider's ascent with a stopwatch off the television footage using figures that haven't been given a great deal of scrutiny, and then coming up with, again, as you say, a watts per kilogram figure, which, and we don't know whether does that indicate something's amiss or not. There's too many of these questions that we don't actually have an answer to at the moment.
I'm no scientist, but there are other factors as well, such as whether a rider is riding on a climb. There are benefits to riding in somebody's slipstream,
and whether a rider's doping.
Yeah, that as well. But those benchmarks that were set by riders that we know were doping, there's no way of knowing what. I know there's been papers done and very estimates taken at the benefits of doping, but we don't know conclusively in terms of a percentage what the benefits were of doping. Well, and they vary from rider to rider as well.
And as I think you made the point, Rich, yesterday was that we don't know with the riders that were doping, that we now know were doping, we don't know from what starting point
they were coming from. Exactly what I mean.
Were these riders, you know, how good were they? Clean. We you know, that's almost an unknowable question in a lot of cases. So, you know, we're comparing apples and oranges and pears, and we've got a bit of a fruit salad, really.
Daniel, what are your thoughts?
To be honest, Rich, there's a lot of literature about this. This is being a hotly debated topic. and I don't feel that I've, you know, I really need to read and digest everything, take it all in before I can, give sort of definitive verdict either way. One thing I would say is that I think these these calculations, these extrapolations, these estimations, they were very useful when they were clear pointers when the margin over what was a ballpark figure for what was clean or physiological was huge. When people were producing what was estimated at 495 watts on a final climb, and most people believe that 410 watts is about what an undoped athlete can do, then yeah, it was useful because it was a very, very clear indicator. Now we're talking about very fine margins. We're talking about Chris Froome maybe going 5 watts over what people think is possible, or 10 watts over. And then when you add in those unknowables that Lionel just mentioned, you know, those variables which could easily shift the figure 5 or 10%, then it becomes, personally, my instinct tells me, fairly pointless doing these calculations and extrapolating from guesstimates.
You made a good point as well, Daniel, the other day about how the doping in the 90s was that was the kind of be all and end all.
The panacea,
and that actually stunted the development of other areas that you would look at in order to improve performance.
Yeah, I mean, was there anything really that people were doing? They were, you know, they were losing weight, they were training, but they were mainly doping, and there was no great incentive to spend a lot of money and a lot of time looking at other methods of legal enhancement. And I think all of those areas, whether it be sports psychology, whether it be aerodynamics, whether it be training, etc., they've had a huge surge forward in the last few years since it's become very difficult to dope with EPO, because teams have had to do that, and you know, consequently, it wouldn't really surprise me that an undoped athlete can now perform almost as well, if not as well, as an athlete. Let's not forget, 12 years ago, Lance Armstrong, we're talking about on that Twiddle Men, it's 2001. That's a long time ago in terms of the evolution of a sport.
Yeah, and you know, I say we'll play more of the Tim Carrison interview later in the week, but he did make the point that that's what they're aiming at. They're aiming for exceptional performances. They're aiming, and that the athletes who do, you know, great sportsmen are outliers, was the term he used. They are. So if they achieve what they want to achieve, they will attract suspicion.
Yeah. The thing Daniel said, I know he said it sort of semi-flippantly as a bit of a joke, but the best indication of doping is if whether a rider is doping.
Yeah.
And, you know, that sounds ridiculously obvious, but in terms of identifying whether the riders who are producing the best performances in the Tour de France are doping, it strikes me as odd that all we're looking at is performance. You know, we've got to look at what else is kind of going on. You know, with Armstrong, for example, there was kind of a permanently smoking gun from 99 onwards. Firstly, with the cortisone positive test that was kind of explained by a doctor's note in 99. I mean, everyone now is kind of revising history to say that it was his performance on Sestriere which made everybody think he was doping. That's not really how the events unfolded. He had failed, in inverted commas, a dope test earlier in the race, which they explained away with a doctor's note. The cloud of suspicion was over him prior to the extraordinary performance, not the other way around. And I think that we're going down a really dangerous path, as you've said over recent days, Rich, if the indication, the first indication for performance, for doping, is an extraordinary performance. Otherwise, we're left with no sport, really, if every single performance is questioned.
Mm.
And so we're on a real sort of treading a bit of a tightrope at the moment, because we don't want to close our eyes to the possibility. Absolutely not. But at the same time, this kind of move into the analysis of performances, as I've said before, on, you know, the open road, not in controlled conditions, is not... It's just adding a lot of noise to the debate, rather than providing a clear way forward.
Where it's relevant, clearly, is to the individual. And this is something Greg LeMond has talked about over many years. And Dave Brailsford actually talked about yesterday, this idea of having a panel of experts, of people that really understand how to interpret power data, to sit alongside the biological passport panel of experts and really analyse the data. And again, I think the relevance is to the individual rather than just as a general rule that somebody who generates this much power is therefore
doping. I really
don't
think this is a road for anti-doping to go down. I mean, can you imagine the legal challenges to something?
Well,
like
no,
this?
I can't. To, yeah, I mean, no, I think I don't think it would be used to sanction. I think it would be used
perhaps?
To target test. Yeah, I think it has to. The analytical test has to take priority, obviously. But
yeah.
I think the power analysis of the power data of individuals and how that fluctuates over the course of a year and a career, that could be used to then, you know, look at the biological passport data a little bit more closely and target people.
But again, that leads us back to kind of a lot of the misinterpretation of what the biological passport actually is amongst. I don't want to overgeneralize, but people think that the biological passport is a matter of positive or negative, or some people think that, and it isn't at all. It's a set of parameters that when an amber light comes on, they look more closely. When a red light comes on, they see whether there's a case to answer. And if it stacks up and stands up, then they will take proceedings. And that is how the biological passport has been set up. It isn't a matter of these results indicate doping, these results indicate clean. It doesn't really work like that. And I think, you know, the issue of power, as you said, is another one where it's all about circumstances and interpretation. You know, power figures on a short climb will be different to power figures on a long climb. Power figures for a rider who's ridden at the front will be different to power figures for a rider who's ridden in the slipstream. And so what are we looking for? What is the answer we're looking for? And it goes back to the you know, the joke about the best indicator of doping is whether a rider is doping, and we have to keep
yeah,
our eyes open,
yeah,
to that.
Keep your eye on the ball. We will return to this topic, but let's hear from Tim Kerrison. This is him talking about Sunday's stage. He's the coach to Chris Froome and most of the Sky team. And quite interesting, quite frank analysis of what happened on Sunday.
One of the hallmarks, I suppose, of Sky in the last couple of years has been consistency. You know, Brad last year, Chris this year. Froome was obviously consistent yesterday, but Richie Porte suffered a bit of a collapse. Is that something that you were sort of mulling over last night, thinking, why did that happen?
Yeah, and I still am, to be honest. I think yesterday was one of the hardest days, one of the most challenging days for us, not just in terms of the performance of the team. And, you know, we came out of it pretty well in the end, in that we're still in the jersey by some margin. But it was a challenging day for the team, a pretty challenging day in terms of understanding the performance as well. When, I think the day before, the team rose to the challenge of the first day in the mountains and performed pretty well, I think. Guys like Cadell, I read, was saying how much he struggled in the heat, but that's no excuse because Team Sky managed to overcome that and you know, rode really strongly as a team. And yet the next day, we didn't cope well at all. So it is something that I'll be having a look at again tonight, just to try and, you know, another talk with the guys to try and understand.
On Saturday, you know, in counter-attacking, went too deep. Saw him also getting a lot of bottles. Was he dehydrated, or?
You know, if you think back to last year, we rode very conservatively, and Saturday wasn't. We didn't ride conservatively. The outcome of that was that we took, you know, Chris took a very, you know, significant margin on GC, and Richie took a margin as well. And the outcome of the past 2 days, if you look, that, you know, we had a very good but aggressive day on Saturday, and then a very challenging day the next day. Overall, we got away with, you know, a pretty good result from Chris's point of view, but potentially it cost us with the rest of the team. You know, we enjoy days like Saturday, but we learn a lot more from days like Sunday. And I think what we're good at as a team is learning from days like yesterday. And we'll go, you know, we'll go and probably for months from now still be mulling over yesterday and everything that led up to that day, and thinking about how we change and how we don't make the same mistakes again, if that's the conclusion we come to.
One of the things last year as well was that the team seem to all be in really great form. They're kind of conditioned. I know they trained as a team for the tour. That was a big one. And you've gone to Tenerife and sacrificed races and so on. That was done again this year. But is the team as well in as good condition, in as good form as they were last year? Is this team?
We've got guys who've, you know, I mean, the other thing that complicated yesterday is probably the guy who has stepped up the most recent, you know, in the last few weeks was Pete Kenner. He crashed, and he was riding fantastically well yesterday, and even after he crashed he rode brilliantly. So he was and he was our man of the match the day before. You know, he rode absolutely brilliantly the day before. We've got guys who are riding very, very well, and we've got other, and I think that always happens. It's the nature of sport and the nature of team sport that you have some guys who surpass your expectations and some guys who don't quite perform to the level you expect. And we've got new guys to our team on, you know, first year in Team Sky on this team. We've learned a lot with some of those guys in terms of how to manage them and how to get them to this point of the season in better shape for next year.
This is a humansinvent.com Tour de France podcast with Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb and Lionel Burney.
Okay, let's rattle through this final part of the podcast. We should mention that our winner of the David Miller phone call competition, Jen Loves Cycling, got her phone call last night from David Miller. I don't know how long it was, but I spoke to him this morning. He said that he talked through.
He said it was one of the best phone calls he's ever had.
Yeah, he really enjoyed it. She certainly enjoyed it, judging from her Twitter feed. So that was a great success.
What a great prize!
I must say that, you know, I felt, you know, my heart sore when I saw what it meant to her. I thought it was a wonderful. We were a bit flippant about the prize, but it was a great prize, and I think we'll be doing another competition this week to win a phone call from either Dan Martin or Ryder Hesjedal next week. So that's exciting. Okay, we've got our Pedaleur de Charme award.
And now Pedaleur de Charme.
Ah, yes, there was Ciro playing in our Pedaleur de Charme. Daniel, you got Pedaleur de Charme.
Well, I think Marcel Kittel is his charm personified, isn't he, Rich?
That's not how you describe him, right? 6'4" of pure condensed German bronzed muscle, I think, is your rather evocative description.
I don't think so. But yeah, he's a very charming man.
He speaks highly of you as well.
Yeah, he's a very charming man.
He is a very charming man.
He's incredibly likable, almost suspiciously likable, in fact. Lionel?
Well, talking about sort of pedalling style more than personality, I like the look of Jérôme Cousin, the Europe car rider today.
Is he 6'4", a French blonde?
No,
calm down.
He looked good when he was putting those digs in on the little climbs just coming into the finish, where I think they got caught maybe 7K from the finish, wasn't it? But
they were going to nominate me for my drive yesterday.
Oh, yeah, of course. Should mention Richard Moore did the full drive yesterday from Bordeaux up to Brittany.
My Pedaleur sans charme is Danny Van Poppel, who I tried to interview this morning, and it was one of those interviews where he'd been at the signing on stage and he wouldn't stop. So he said, "Can you interview me while we're riding?" While he's riding very slowly back to his team bus, I was kind of jogging ungallantly alongside tape recorders stuck out and looking really in sandals as well. It wasn't easy. I asked him a few questions, and he was answering them. He's the youngest rider in the race, and then I asked him how long he thought he could last into, and he literally just sprinted off. he just rode away from me really fast. Out the saddle. It was incredible. I was left standing there looking like a complete idiot. Anyway, so right, we've got a few questions.
Can I change my Pedaleur de Charme to Danny Van Poppel?
Right, can we rattle through? We got some questions from people. Let's just do them quickly. Who are the? This is from Jens Hagstrom. Who are the best riders to approach after a stage for an honest account of what happened?
I think Mark Cavendish was pretty honest, certainly sort of transparent today. I think you got a fairly clear perspective of what he felt about the stage from his reactions, emotive. In terms of sort of a breakdown of the stage, Laurens ten Dam is quite good. Always a good talker.
Well, he was another one who actually avoided my interview this morning, but never mind.
We tried to ask him about barbecues, didn't we? The team presentation, he just ignored us.
Now, okay, here's another one. Adrian Hunt, what happened to Vasily Kirienka? Really happened, not Team Sky propaganda.
Well, what I mean, what is Team Sky propaganda? The answer that Team Sky gave. I mean, how do we ascertain?
We spoke a little bit with Dave Brailsford about this, didn't we?
We did. Yeah, I think basically a combination of factors, including working extremely hard on Saturday's stage, perhaps not taking care of rehydration, and then. On the when it all kicked off on Sunday stage, he put in a big effort to try and drag Richie Port back up, and basically blew his lights out.
Mm.
And then
one other person on Twitter did ask a rumor. Ruth Prendergast asked other DSs denying him water.
True.
Is that true?
True, I heard today.
You heard that as well. Yeah. I didn't hear that.
I heard that from someone who was in. The team cast.
That's pretty shocking, isn't it?
That is pretty shocking. I mean,
very unusual.
Have thought they'd give him, Sky, with their obsession with marginal gains, you would think they would give them all €10 in the morning to put in their pockets so they could stop at a garage or a service station.
But
wouldn't you?
I think Kirienka would have spent it on, I don't know.
I once found myself 45 miles out of Aberdeen. Oh my goodness. Outside Aberdeen with no money and blowing up completely. Yeah. And I swapped my watch for a couple of Mars bars and a can of Coke. It was brilliant. I had to cycle back a couple of days later and hand over the money for my watch. But yeah, it was worth it at the time. He must have been wearing a watch.
Obviously not, because he was outside the time limit.
There's a question from Dan Kearns. I'm not sure if I can really say that. Can I say that, Lionel?
Okay, don't say it, Rich.
No.
Let's just crack on, shall we?
Any other questions? No, I can't ask that one either. From Debbie M. Why is Cavendish 0-6 in intermediate sprints contested with Greipel so far this tour? Well, that's Greg Keller. I think Cavendish doesn't. I mean, now especially he's falling well behind in the green jersey competition, but he's never been seemed fully committed to these intermediate sprints. He seems to be going through the motions with them. It kind of ties into a point Daniel made, I think, at the start of the tour, where he finds even in smaller races sometimes he needs a big occasion, and I don't think an intermediate sprint is a big enough occasion.
No, I think he just feels that you can't afford now to opt out completely. But on the other hand, I think it's okay as long as you score, as long as you're within 2 or 3 points of the guys you're direct. Antagonist for the green jersey.
Okay, that we've been through a few, but we got more questions, and sorry we've not really got time to go through them all, but please do send us any questions that you have. If you hashtag #HumansInventTDF, we'll try to answer those.
On a quieter day, we'll get through a lot more of those.
We'll get through more, and we've got other things coming up this week. Brian Cookson interview, UCI president nominee. I think there's an interview with Brian Cookson gone up on humansinvent.com. Look out on the website for other articles relating to cycling and the Tour de France this week and next week as well. That's all from us tonight. Daniel, thank you.
No worries. Anytime, Rich.
Lionel, thanks.
See you again tomorrow.
Thank you to me as well.
Thank you, Richard.
Should we pay?